Today's presentation is Working with Families, Law Enforcement, and Mental Illness by John Gernand. It relates to our second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. John Gernand has been a volunteer, advocate, and educator for NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness, for more than 20 years. He believes that speaking out about mental illness helps immensely to reduce the stigma those who suffer from mental health disorders and their families experience. John has worked and or volunteered in juvenile prisons, adolescents, and in psychiatric lockdown units. We look forward to your words, John. Thank you.
Good morning. As Matt said, I've been working as an advocate with mental illness for about 20 years. It all started when my youngest son came down with a serious mental illness. And since that point, I've been reaching out into the community and trying to make things as best as possible for him. When I talk to police officers in CIT training, which is critical intervention training, I'm talking about families. And why am I talking about families? I'm talking about families because most often when officers receive a 911 call and they go out to a house, they're not meeting with the person with the health, mental health problem. The person that answers that door is the mother or father, or grandmother or aunt and uncles. And typically they're working just as much or more with the family than they are with the person with a mental illness. So how do I start my presentation when I go with out to see police officers or meet at a CIT training? I try to take it from the top down. I tell officers, we get a 911 call for a mental crisis emergency. We drive up to the house, we're going down the street, and what do we start doing? We start profiling, which we're not supposed to do, but we as humans can't help that. We profile. And that means we start assuming things, which we don't want to do. And I tell them the only thing you really want to assume is when you pull up to that house, there may be a very loving family in there, a caring family, trying all they can to help with the person with a mental health crisis in their home. Another thing I want to remind them is they're pulling up to a house that are under the influence, strongly, strongly under the influence. Not under the influence of alcohol or drugs, but under the influence of trauma, grieving, broken families and disruptive family, individuals feeling tremendous amounts of guilt, social isolation, feelings of shame. Families experience loss, real loss. They've lost the child that they thought they brought into the world. It's catastrophic. So we have all these words up here, but what does that mean? That's not what you're seeing in the home. Where you're gonna find out about these first impressions is listening to the feelings that people are going through. The trauma, they're going through a catastrophic stressor in their home. These people met with a doctor who told them that their loved one, maybe their someone immediately in their family, is living with a lifetime disease without a cure. How would you feel? It'd be terrible. The anxiety, confusion, struggling with emotions, memories that won't go away. They're grieving, looking at fear, panic, denial, confusion, regret, sadness, depression, and spiritual questions like, why me? Broken families, emotionally exhausted with what's going on, trying to weave their way through society and medical and doctors and state and money. And also financial exhaustion. There's a lot of financial exhaustion. I know when my first son, when my son got sick, about a week later, I got a prescription from the doctor at $1,200 a month. That was a punch in the gut. That was another mortgage. It exhausted our financial being right then. We weren't able to go on vacations. We stopped going out to dinners and stuff like that just to be able to pay for the medication. Guilt, there's a lot of discrimination. Parents are wrongly believed I don't know if you know it, until about 1960, the mother was responsible for mental illness. Suzanne and I had an OMNI affiliate in the Southern Appalachian Mountains. And we had mothers that came into our meeting that were ousted from the family, that were kicked out of the family for bearing a child with a mental illness. Terrible. It's not that way now, but back in the country and in rural areas, we can still find that. Shame and humiliation due to stigma. Have you ever seen that guy walk into the Walmart or the grocery store holding the hand of a Down syndrome child, pushing the wheelchair of a child with cerebral palsy, spinal bifida, muscles are all ataxic and tight? Or the kid walking in that's all goofy and he's touching everything, his OCD is out of control and playing with things. I am that guy. I've been there. That's not fun. Have respect for those guys. They're standing straight, they're walking tall, and they're moving forward. Uh-oh, it's not going to the next screen. Okay, so what do families expect? We're there at the front door. We're getting to walk into the house. What do they expect? They expect respect and dignity, just like any human being deserves. They want to acknowledge that they know best. Those people in the house, the people you're visiting, they know their loved one's triggers, and then they know their coping skills. You want to know them right away. You don't want to go anywhere near those triggers, and you want to use those coping skills when communicating and talking with the family. They want you to ask questions and not give demands. They want clarification of who you are and how you can help. Having your CIT certification, it's good to tell them, let them know. I've been trained. I'm trained to do this. I want to come into your house and help you. They want you to use the right words and the right phrases to ease the tension in their home so that you can move forward. They want to be given options and not threats. So what approach can we take? We walk into that house. We can show empathy. We can use a calm and relaxed body language. We can use a calm and relaxed tone, pitch, pace, and modulation of voice. We can express hope. Not too much hope. You want to be a little careful with hope. Hope is a two-way street. It may not always come true, kind of like a prayer or a wish. We can find the appropriate environment to speak in. You don't want to have a family on a couch with you standing over them, hovering over them. Make sure you find a place in the house where everybody is at the same level so that you can talk freely without dominating the conversation by standing over them. We can listen. We can really, really listen to find out their concerns, their wants, and their needs. So often, what do? We listen only to reply. Stop doing that. Listen to find out what you need to carry on the conversation and help as you can. You can use words that are not accusatory, threatening, or fearful. And you can structure our language and questions into positive outcomes. Empathy. Empathy is probably going to be your biggest tool in your toolbox, the biggest verb and action that you can bring with you. Empathy lowers tension. Empathy is the ability to recognize, understand, and share the feelings and thoughts of another person, not your own. So important. It's not your feelings. If someone comes up to you and says, my son's been sick for 2 or 3 years, and you say, oh, I know someone that's been sick for 2 or 3 years. Those are your feelings. Don't go there. Don't talk about you. Talk about them and their feelings. Empathy builds trust. Empathy shows that you have some understanding or you're interested in what their feelings are and how you can help. Empathy is expressed through your physical presence, your body language, as well as your words. Have you ever walked into work one day and someone's over in the walks in and goes, "Hey, Bob, how are you doing?" And he says, "Well, pretty good, but my brother died over the weekend." So what do? Your shoulders drop, bend your elbows a little bit, and you speak with a soft tone. You go, "I'm so sorry." That's empathy. That's empathy through your body language. Empathy can only be shown personally and not professionally. Let's say you go to the hospital and the doctor comes out over surgery and he's in his shrub, he's in his operating clothes and everything. And he says, "Hey, I'm sorry, things didn't work out the way we wanted to. How about meeting me in my office in 5 minutes?" The doctor comes into his office and there he's a person. He's not a doctor. He's a real person. He's able to show empathy, being an individual and being a person. Same way you can as a police officer. Don't show empathy as a police officer. Try to show yourself, your personal self, when you express empathy to them. Works a lot better. Empathy warning. There's a warning with empathy. Speak only to someone's feelings and not your own, like I mentioned earlier. Empathy is not giving advice. Empathy is not making judgments. Empathy is not sympathy. Sympathy is going along with things. Empathy is not to take pity on somebody. So important to understand that. Words the family want to hear. Words people want to hear. So often, we let words slip off of our tongue that when you're done, you wish you didn't use. Let's go over a couple of them and look at them. How about be reasonable? That's terrible. No one admits to being unreasonable. You're inviting conflict. Try. Reason with them in a real logical meaning. Like, I'm being as reasonable as I can. I don't know how to do it any better. It'll get better here as we keep going. But right now, I see the problem a little differently than you do. How about come here? Almost laugh, it's so terrible. It's threatening, it's a command. Like they haven't obeyed. Try, excuse me, can we sit down and have a chat? That works a lot better. Because those are the rules. God, we heard that as kids. You know, your father stands there and says, because I'm the father, that's why. That really doesn't work. Try explaining the rules to be very specific. A lot of times when individuals are going to go to the hospital with the police, the Madison Police Force has a rule that you have to be handcuffed. Parents flip out about them. Why are you handcuffing my son? We're not here for a criminal reason. It's their policy. Sit down and explain to the people why it's the policy. By the time you're explaining, they may think, oh, this is okay. And they can talk to their loved one and try to ease the tension from that. How about what's your problem? That's snotty. It signals this is a you versus me battle. Oops.
You're still here.
A you versus me battle, rather than an us discussion, puts the problem back on the one who needs our assistance. Try, what's the matter? How can I help you? Start a real conversation with the people, with the individuals. You never or you always. That's accusatory. Absolute generalizations are probably a lie. They're probably not true. Like, you never clean your room. No, wait a minute. I cleaned your room last Wednesday. You could say, you haven't cleaned your room since last Wednesday. Or, you never take your medicine. They may have taken their medicine once or twice. You can say, I don't see you taking your medicine very well. Or, I've noticed that the the agreement we had is to take our medicine, and I don't see that being followed. Phrases that family want to hear and that are going to work for you to ease the tension in the house. Let me be sure I heard what you said. Pure empathy, best phrase ever. Prevents you from being misunderstood. Prevents you from being misunderstood. Being misunderstood is probably the worst situation you could be in. When you're misunderstood and you say something incorrectly, or you don't repeat back to them the right words, what do they say? You're not listening to me. You don't care. You don't care. How come you even came here? You have no interest in me. You don't want to be in that situation. It gives you a chance to really find out what they said so you don't make a mistake. Is there anything I can do to gain your cooperation? It's positive. It's pleasant. It's reaching out. Follow up with, I'd sure like to think there is something that we can cooperate on. Help me understand the pain and feelings. Explain to me what you think and what's causing so much fear and anxiety and distress. It's asking for cooperation. It's reaching out. It's showing empathy. So why do we do all this? Our goal, at least my goal, is when I go into a house and I start the whole thing going and I'm talking to people, I'm trying to gain voluntary compliance. Voluntary compliance to sit, talk, and be honest with one another. Voluntary compliance to calm down. Voluntary compliance to get help. Maybe go to the hospital. Maybe go downtown. Voluntary compliance to hear each other out. You know, as a police officer, that's what you're trying to do. You're going to these houses not because someone's in a burglary, there's not been a shooting or weapons or anything like that. You're trying to help. You're trying to help. Well, thank you. If you got any questions, let me know. Most of the time is very, very positive. This is making their job easier. You know, when a police officer, if they lay their hands on somebody, that's taking a half hour report they got to write into a 4 hour report and a meeting with their lieutenant or their sergeant or so forth of why did you have to show involuntary compliance and put your hands on somebody. If you do a verbal de-escalation and you're able to get out of that house, keeping people calm, without touching them and only using your voice and your body, you get a star on your shoulder when you leave. It makes their job so much easier. I've told a lot of police have told me that. They're going, God, I can use this in my field of work without having to get all police-like in someone's home. About a year ago, I was at a presentation. An older policeman, he came up to me. He says, John, I've worn a pistol on my hip for 32 years, and I've never pulled it out. But I get 50 hours of training every year of how to use it. I deal with the mentally ill 6 to 7 times a day, and I have zero training. A lot of these guys haven't had any training at all. Now, today, they're bringing it in to cadets, and it used to be voluntary. And the cops that did it voluntarily were kind of giving that it's a soft touch, we don't need you type thing. It's mandatory now to take CIT training. And they're really happy they're getting it after they learn how to use it and learn techniques and verbal de-escalation. You know, CIT training is a 40-hour program for police. I'm just one part of it. There's a lot of seminars that come in with doctors and nurses and behavioralists and stuff, and we're all working on this. And for the last 2 days, there's a lot of role-playing. A lot of role-playing out in the field as well as in the class. I know the last one we did, we work with policemen that on a patrol stop. They come up to a car and someone may be having cognitive difficulties or something. And the cop says, license and registration. Now, how long do you think it takes a cop before they start flipping out because of non-response? It doesn't take very long. And we found out that a lot of people that have cognitive problems are very slow at processing. It can take up to 15 or 20 seconds for someone to process that whole thing and pull out their license and work on the registration thing. Most police officers didn't want to wait more than 10 seconds before they're ready to pull you out of the car. And so we worked a lot on that on the last role play I was giving, is having patience. Some people don't process as fast as you do. Some people need extra time to do that. We work a lot on that. A lot of patience. It's like if there's I was on a call one time where there was a child up in a tree and he wasn't coming down. Cops were getting all restless. Well, you're not going to shoot him out of the tree. You're not going to drag him out of the tree. You're going to sit there and you're going to talk and you're going to wait and you're going to wait and you're going to wait and you're going to wait. You're just going to have, you have to show the patience. You may get some food and put it at the bottom of the tree and have the vapors of the good smells coming up to bring them down. But if you are sitting in the back of a patrol car, you are handcuffed. And they have their reasons and they have their reasons and reasons. And some of them make sense, but I would love it if they didn't. Now, a lot of police officers that are in the critical intervention training are officers that are specifically in the group to go out to these calls. They come in without a uniform on. But if they get in the back of the car, they have to handcuff them. And they're looking at this policy. Maybe they can change it. But that's the way their policy is right now. And it's a real common policy. It's not just only Madison. But I agree, it's a little threatening when someone tells you to put your hands behind your back. One thing I left out of what I was talking about is one real important thing police officers have to do when they go to a house, and if they're getting the family together, if they're sitting at a table, is go over the resources that are available to them in the community so they can find housing, they can find psychiatrists, they can find therapists, and all that kind of stuff. NAMI puts out a booklet of resources for the mentally ill, which is fantastic. It's a really, really good pamphlet. And they hand it to the families and go over the different areas of the book that may be help to them. But that's so important to give them resources. It's like I said, the emotional exhaustion. These people don't know where to turn. It's during these crisis calls, intervention calls, that we have time to go over the resources that are available. They're not getting a lot, I'll tell you, especially with parenting and things like that. I mean, if Suzanne and I teach a class with NAMI called, it's a 12-week, 8-week program called Family to Family, where we're trying to talk to mothers and fathers of children
adults.
And adults with mental illness, of different techniques of working with them in the home. And a lot of it has to do with vocabulary. And the other half has to do with helping them understand what's going on, what the whole thing is with the medicine, what the whole thing is with Social Security and Medicare and that whole thing. And I'd love to roll out these type of programs into schools and things like that. I also teach a program called In the Silence, which is a suicide prevention in high school programs. And I'm teaching kids to react with their friends. When you see friends that are having difficulty and so forth, you want to reach out, you want to speak to your teachers. If they're not talking to their teachers, you want to go to their teachers, or you want to go to their administrator and going, I think Judy or John has a problem. You think you can help out? I know in suicides, I mean, I'd say about 90% of the time, people are asking for help. And you just can't walk away. They want help. It's like that one kid the other day who shot the four people, and that note, he was asking for help. He put it on a note to the teachers, help me. They didn't help. And for parents and teachers, police officers, nursing, you've got to put yourself in a position that you're willing to de-escalate instead of escalate the situation, which happens so often with people that don't understand the techniques of helping people lower the tension. Well, we could all use the training. It's in the workplace, no matter where, if you get a little training, you can be a big help. One thing I also wanted to bring up, as a tip, if anybody is in a position where they have to call the police because they think something's happening to the point where it's an emergency, when you call 911 or anything, tell them that you want a CIT officer to come to the house. And nobody else. I want a CIT officer. That's an officer that's been trained in critical intervention. And you'll get an officer to come that's had 40 hours of training. If someone's causing a threat or there is a weapon present, the police have to go into police action. And I don't blame them. They can do it as nicely as they can, but they're going to have to stop the punching, the fighting, the slapping. And if there's a weapons, they got to protect themselves and the other people in the room or where they're around. So that happens. I know with myself, hundreds of times I've gone out with police officers, I don't go in the house if I think there's any weapons. And I make sure it's clear that there are no weapons or no immediate threat to myself before I walk into a house. That's why the police are good to have there. I mean, they're providing a function. It's going to be a lot easier for dispatch to be able to signal that call or send that call to the right people and to the right areas where people are. I think it's great. What is it, 899 or something like that? It's supposed to come out this year, next year, but it's supposed to come out early in the year. And the reallocating funds, when they do a CIT, is not cheap. I mean, they're taking an officer off his beat or out of his patrol car for 40 hours where he's not doing his typical job, and they're paying him to take this training. So it does cost money. Well, one thing I remind police officers is that they're not going to fix it. They're not doctors. They're not therapists. They're not going to fix it. Their biggest deal, I think, is to bring in, lower the tension of the house and see what's going on. And if they need to bring in other people, then they have the option to do that. So a lot of times it's to settle in and find out what resources they have available and what resources they can give the people. If they need to go to the hospital because it's an emergency psychiatric problem, or if they need to get social services involved immediately, they can do that. The police serve a really good purpose, and the fact that a lot of these calls are dealing with some violence. I mean, when a kid's just breaking everything in the house, it's throwing every possible thing, breaking every possible thing he can find in the house. He's hitting his mother or he's punching holes in the wall. Police can work good on that level, more so than a social worker or someone else can work on that level. So if they can get in and identify the resources that are needed and call them up and get them in there. But it is a two-way thing. It takes professional help as well as police help sometimes both.